This episode of Revision Path is brought to you by Facebook Design. Facebook Design works on an enormous and diverse range of interesting problems. So I asked UX research manager Reggie Murphy, what's his biggest challenge with designing for Facebook? And here's what he said.
Is knowing that you are designing at scale and the awesome responsibility that brings with it to try to understand the people that you're designing for and understanding what they need.
Learn more at facebook.com/design. Are you looking for a job? Do you know someone who's looking for a job? Then check out our job board over at revisionpath.com/jobs. Whether you want a full-time job or you're looking for something temporary or freelance, we've got you covered. This week, MailChimp is looking for the following engineering positions: software engineer, senior software engineer, iOS engineer, Android engineer, data engineer, data software engineer, director of product engineering, director of mobile engineering, and they're looking for a product designer. RevUnit is looking for a senior UX and UI designer. Dev Bootcamp is looking for a senior software developer instructor, as well as a lead engineer. HyperAct is looking for a brand strategist, and Bandcamp is looking for a designer. We also have job listings from Indeed.com, so head to the Revision Path job board at revisionpath.com/jobs to apply and to search for any other listings. Don't forget to sign up for weekly job alerts, and when there are new positions that are added to the job board, you'll get an email so you can be the first to apply. And if you're looking for even more jobs, then become a member of our Slack community and join the jobs channel. See you there.
You're listening to the Revision Path Podcast, a weekly showcase of the world's Black graphic designers, web designers, and web developers. Through in-depth interviews, you'll learn about their work, their goals, and what inspires them as creative individuals. Here's your host, Maurice Cherry.
Welcome to the Revision Path Podcast. My name is Maurice Cherry, and before we get into this week's interview, let's talk about our sponsors, MailChimp, Hover, and SiteGround. Join more than 15 million people who use MailChimp to not only send emails, but to grow their businesses on their own terms. Start sending professional-looking newsletters to your clients today for free. By the way, have you seen their new marketing campaign with the different names for MailChimp, like Whale Synth, Veil Him, Snail Primp? Actually, the snail primp one isn't too far-fetched. There's, I don't know if you know this, but there's sheet masks that you can buy that have quote-unquote snail essence in them. I guess it's some kind of like snail slime for your face. I don't know. Anyway, we'll put a link to all that in the show notes so you can check out their entire campaign. And if you want to sign up for MailChimp, head on over to MailChimp.com. MailChimp. Send better email. When you have a great idea for a project, you need to give it a great domain name. And guess what? Finding the perfect domain name is ridiculously easy with Hover. Most people don't realize that when you register a domain with your contact information, it's published in this Whois database, which is free for spammers and hackers and anybody else who wants to get your information to send you messages to your email, to your home, you know. And unlike some other companies, Hover includes free Whois privacy with all supported domains to keep your information confidential. Go to hover.com/revisionpath and get 10% off your first purchase. Again, that's hover.com/revisionpath. Hover, domain names for your ideas. SiteGround's hosting services are crafted for professional, business, or enterprise projects. So whether you're building something custom or you're using a CMS like WordPress, which is what we use, SiteGround lets you build better, faster, safer websites more easily, and they offer multiple hosting options that your websites can grow into. And we've got a fantastic deal for you. Visit siteground.com/revisionpath and you can get 60% off on all hosting plans. Again, 60%, siteground.com/revisionpath. We have a new iTunes review. This is from JAA0829, and the review is titled Love This Show. Here it goes. I'm a recent computer science graduate that has been struggling to get my foot in the industry for the last year. This show gives insight on so many different career paths in the design field. I enjoy hearing these different designers' true experience of how it is working in the industry. It keeps me optimistic through my job search process. Well, thank you so much for that review, JAA0829, and good luck on the job search. I know it's rough out there. So if you haven't already, you know, check out our job board, see if there's something there that might be for you. Now let's go ahead and get on to this week's interview. I'm back at Google, and I'm talking with senior interaction designer Chikizi Ijiasi. Let's start the show. All right, so tell us who you are and what you do.
My name is Chikizi Ijiasi. I'm a senior interaction designer at Google.
So talk to the audience about what exactly interaction design is. I know there's a lot of different types of design, and there's titles that change as the industry changes. But to you, what is interaction design?
Yeah, it's actually interesting because that question could also be answered based off of where you work. So I know a lot of people that are actually, they're self-declared product designers, and then there's the visual designers, and then there's motion designers. I see personally, there's probably a different definition, but I see interaction designer as bridging a lot of those different pillars. I see interactions as the actual thing that people do, the experience of when they first open up either your app or a device or even a game. It's the first moment up until the last time that they use it. I see that as an experience. So, yeah, you also have the title of user experience designer, but that to me is a mouthful. So I just say interaction designer.
Okay. No, and I see what you mean. Like sometimes you'll work different places. They have different names. I know like Automatic, for example, all their names are wildly different.
Right.
I mean, there you have like Happiness Engineer. I think one guy is called like Chief Barbecue Taster, but he's really like the CTO or something like that.
Okay, I'm making an official name change.
So you've been at Google for a while, and you've worked on some pretty big projects. You worked on the Nest thermostat. Nest Protect. Okay. Right. You worked on Google Plus. And now you're working with Daydream and VR. For those that aren't familiar, what is the Daydream, I guess, platform?
Daydream platform is Google's VR platform. It's their headset. It's a smartphone VR system where you have your Google Pixel. And then you can place that inside of a mobile VR headset. Usually VR headsets require a cable connected directly to your PC. So similar to the Samsung Gear VR, this is a device that lets you experience VR on the go, like on a bus or a plane or something.
So is this kind of like a step up from Google Cardboard?
Yeah. Cardboard was commonly referred to as like a snackable VR. It's like you have to hold the headset on your face while you're using it. It's very much like it's accessible VR, which I like to call it. But the Daydream is definitely more high fidelity. Get a lot more detail. There's a strap that you can hold on your head. It comes with a remote and it's way more immersive.
And what kinds of experiences are you creating on Daydream?
Personally, I mean, I just started on the team, so I haven't yet fully contributed to any new experiences, but the team at Google is mostly focused on creating unique VR experiences and the same experiences that you get on your phone. Like we have a Street View app, which is pretty awesome. We have the Google Play app or the YouTube app. Those are all like really good experiences on Daydream.
Why do you think VR is so popular right now? Like I remember in the 90s when I don't want to say that this is when VR kind of first came out, but I remember hearing about VR in the 90s, and it was kind of cheesy. It was like Virtual Boy and VR troopers and stuff, and now it's like this big thing that you'll see at CES, and there are these, you know, multi-hundred-dollar platforms around VR. Why is it becoming so popular right now?
I think there's a couple different answers there. From the experience perspective, it really is a whole new frontier of a new way to experience games and even utility apps, for example. It's kind of like the amplification of taking a thing that you used to do to the next level by fully immersing you in a completely different world. You know, VR is a pretty fascinating construct. You know, for a while, it's been the headset. And when we talk about VR, a lot of the times we also talk about augmented reality, because there's a certain field of view that you're looking at. Like whenever we look through our eyes, we see like a certain field of view. And with virtual reality, you know, we can't just put a giant 120-inch size like TV of UI in front of your face, because that would be incredibly overwhelming. It's a really interesting way of thinking about how to create experiences that not only take you to a different place, but also aren't completely overwhelming. And I think with that comes new design challenges. And I think there's kind of a excitement factor to that, where a lot of designers don't yet know how to design for VR, simply because there's no limitation. There's no edge of the phone to put a box around. There's no, you have to rely on the controller to move stuff around. You can't just rely on 2D graphics anymore. It's really about space design. Interior design becomes a much more valuable practice to understand.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. So knowing about, you know, placement and proximity and scale and all right. of that becomes more important.
Definitely. Definitely. When laying things out on a phone, it's really about navigating from one screen to another, or transitioning from one state to another. In VR, you have not only that, but you also have the spatial relationship between things. And, you know, mimicking going from one screen to the next screen to the next screen to the next screen, VR, it doesn't really feel all that special, because you feel like you just took a 2D experience and you made it 3D. And it's not the most exciting thing, but if you can really find unique ways to navigate somebody through an experience, that's kind of uncharted territory still.
Well, I feel like also kind of adding that realism factor, you would include your other senses. Like you're saying, VR is kind of growing out of the headset, which is what we see, but I would imagine you add in the other senses, you know, auditory feedback, touch feedback. It ends up becoming more real, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Yeah, there's a virtual reality right now. Yeah, there is kind of a focus on eyesight. But yeah, I'm also curious what's going to happen when we start talking about integrating audio. Because even when I was talking about AR, for example, AR is mostly visual. You know, we take a live feed and then we project something on it. Not many people realize that augmented reality has been around for a very long time in very subtle ways, like the first down line in football. You know, that's augmented reality. Uh-huh. And then you have the backup camera on a car. It's not the Toyota Corolla with AR. It's just the Toyota Corolla with the backup camera. And it just happens to project lines to make it easy for you to back out of your driveway. So it's really interesting how AR is somewhat more invisible than VR. And I think that's because AR is right now a technology that's being added to make the experience better. Whereas VR, you have to consciously put on a headset to enter that space. So it's interesting how the two technologies are different, but in a lot of ways they're similar, where they're manipulating or improving the real world to offer you something different.
So what kind of tools are you using when you're designing with this platform? Because I'm thinking, if there are designers out there that are interested and want to get into VR, I mean, is that something that Photoshop does? Can Sketch do that? Like, what kind of tools do you use?
Yeah, so that's definitely one of the biggest questions that comes up whenever I talk to other designers that are interested in getting in VR is what are the differences in the process? Where, you know, traditionally you'll start up with a sketch, like a drawing, and you'll move into either wireframes, or depending on your skill set, you just jump right into high fidelity comps. And then depending on your skill set as well, you might go into prototyping. My favorite prototyping tool personally is Principle, simply because of its artboard nature. But after that, you would essentially make a spec and then you deliver that to engineering. With VR, that completely, it kind of changes the game a little bit. But in a way, it kind of returns me back to my roots of designing in Flash, where, you know, I'd start off with low fidelity sketches, just get the idea of what I'm trying to convey. And then I'll make low fidelity sketches in Sketch. I'll just make like gray boxes, put the world like a background behind it. And I'll come back to that in a second. And then prototyping or building that UI in a tool called Unity. Unity is a very powerful game engine. And it's fascinating how hard it is to go from Sketch to Unity. Not because they're different apps, but simply because when you're designing in Sketch, you're designing a flat interface. And usually with our interfaces, there's like a background. It's not just like a solid white background. There's usually something there, especially in VR. And but the problem is that, you know, that's not really how the user experiences that environment. And that's not how they experience that UI. The UI is not just flat in front of their face in VR. It's actually curved. Usually it's curved around them. So it's just something is really interesting to see how less time I spend in Sketch now, simply because I need to spend more time in Unity, imagining how that UI is going to feel when it's on their, like in front of their face. Like you don't want to create UI that's too big because it feels overwhelming. You're just looking at like, it's like standing a foot away from like a movie theater. Nobody likes sitting in that front row for a reason. So it's how far back do you put people? And all of those things have to come into consideration when designing those things.
Now, virtual reality is growing in popularity. There's a lot of different VR headsets and systems out there. Daydream, of course. Oculus, there's others I can't think of right off the top of my head, but I know that there are several that are out there. So virtual reality is kind of growing in popularity, but I don't think it still hasn't hit that kind of mainstream adoption yet. What do you think it'll take to get there?
Definitely was grappling with that before I joined Daydream, but I think even for myself, I wasn't using VR as much as I do now at home. I think that's the reason why I like Daydream in particular, is because it's not attached to a PC. I don't have to lug around a computer with me when I'm using the things. Mm-hmm. But there is kind of the cultural challenges of when I put on a headset, I'm not really paying attention to the world that really exists. So it's going to be a challenge for a while. Many know, like, the first thought that comes to somebody's mind is like, okay, what if you make the headset more invisible? What if they're just glasses? It's like, well, there's a problem with that too.
Well, Google would know that.
Right. Leave that topic for another time. Yeah. All right. Oh, man. Yeah, it's interesting how it's just the consciousness of, it's like I'm wearing a headset. Can other people see I'm wearing a headset? There's social factors that come with that. But, you know, when they're in there, people really enjoy it and they really have a lot of fun. You know, there's obviously experiences that people react differently to different experiences. They can get motion sick or something, but the people generally have a good time. But it's just it's like, okay, I'm going into VR now. I'm ready to do this. I'm going to spend the next 20 minutes doing this. It's a mode that you go in.
Now, the VR experiences that I've seen, you know, they are these, you know, like you said, they're these immersive environments that kind of take you out of reality and kind of put you into another world. One thing that I really have not seen, and I feel like this could be an ideal use. Maybe this could be the thing that could take VR mainstream, communication purposes. Mm-hmm. So like talking with relatives far away, or even, you know, not so far away, but like, so for example, I'm in Atlanta. I'm in Georgia. My mother and my grandmother are just a state over in Alabama. And, you know, I go home every now and then, but not all the time, because they live in like the sticks where technology is, you know, a nice idea, but not a necessity of life like it is in metropolitan areas.
Right.
And, you know, I talk to my grandmother every now and then, and she's always like, oh, you should call more. I want to see you. I'm thinking, what if, like, we both had these VR headsets or whatever, and she could put hers on and I could put mine on, and then it's the direct one-to-one connection because she's seeing me, I'm seeing her, we're talking somewhat, you know, I guess in real time. It does take you out of the rest of the world, but then that's kind of what you want, spend time with family, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's definitely a sense of, like, if you, let's say, for example, you're both in like a space together and you're both sitting on a chair and you're just talking to one another. I think it's fascinating to solve the communication problem, not only for the sake of keeping up with family, but also even for professional services like, you know, medicine, business, politics, even. So yeah. I think there's definitely a possibility. The challenge with person-to-person communication via VR is the person, the representation of the person itself. And I can go super deep on that. There's so many things that I've learned. But I think the challenge is you're wearing the headset. So the person that the other person sees might not be a full representation of you. So
avatar or something.
Right, exactly. It's like an avatar representation. So how are you getting those inputs from people? So what we saw from like the Facebook example, the Oculus demo that they did a few months back, It was a cartoon avatar. They didn't have lower bodies, from what I could tell. And their arms were kind of positioned like 90 degrees or so because they were holding these Oculus touch controllers. So it was like a pretty good representation of a person. It's pretty abstract, but it's cartoony, right? And it's cartoony because you can get away with faking certain things, like the swaying of the shoulders or the swaying of the hips. When you start getting into the facial expressions, that becomes difficult because if you're having a serious conversation and we're having to talk about medical supplies being delivered on time, and I keep giggling and smiling. My avatar keeps giggling and smiling. What does that mean, right? So there's certain challenges that come with representing people in virtual reality because human beings are just so complicated in their own that it's hard to always translate perfectly the emotions of a person. You know, we have video conferences now, which are way more accessible, but that becomes challenging as well because, you know, the you have a headset, so you don't get a full picture of your face. So there's definitely, I guess the note there is just, it's definitely a challenge that needs to be solved, which is the communication factor. But yeah.
Well, you know, if there's any place that could solve it, it's Google. Mm-hmm. You know, get a bunch of engineers in a room. Mm-hmm. You guys watch like some Futurama episodes. Just make it happen.
Right.
I mean, part of what you're saying with that is, you know, it sort of boils down to what's humans would accept as the representation of self in a virtual space.
Mm-hmm.
And so is it, you know, real high fidelity, or is an avatar okay? Is it something like Second Life, or is it, you know, something more like Google Hangouts, or it's right. a video chat? So it's all about kind of, it feels to me like it's about, you know, not only what that representation is, but how you put that representation forth to people mm-hmm. in order for them to accept it. I mean, right. You look at chat rooms and things like that. Mm-hmm. In the 90s and even the 2000s, people are like, you're just chatting with people in a room and you can't see them.
Right.
And you don't know what they look like. You could be talking to anybody. But like it's such,
right.
But chatting and SMS and WhatsApp and all this stuff is such an integral part of communications now because we've just grown to accept it through right. society.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, yeah, all the Mr. Robot stuff aside, I know people are wrong, Hopefully they haven't.
Yeah.
One thing that you mentioned when we talked earlier, we talked, you know, before we recorded, is that you were telling me that you were very anti-conference.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think it was kind of a developed sense that I've gotten. It's just a lot of the conferences that I've gone to, I don't want to name any of them in particular, but a lot of the ones I go to, they're just not diverse. I would just be sitting there for, you know, usually a day or 2 days, depending on how long the conference is, and just not hear from not only people that didn't look like me, but women as well. It was always a homogenous group of men that just constantly were up on the stage. And that's fine. If you're getting like your buddies together, you're putting together a conference, it's fine. But the lack of representation becomes bothersome. And based off of what I know about the value of diverse voices, is that's just not the maximum amount of potential of knowledge that I could be getting. My favorite conference was XOXO. I mean, it's the non-annual conference. Mm-hmm. Where they were having it every year, but they stopped last year. But that one was the only conference that I personally knew. I know there's others where they went out of their way to get diverse voices on stage. And that's where I heard a lot of stories from women on stage that opened up my perspective on the treatment of women in tech. And it's because I was going to these conferences that they weren't talking about it. They were only talking about the technical details or the fun happy hours that they had or how to create company culture. It's almost invisible to a lot of people that they don't know to look. Thankfully for me, growing up Black and in the Midwest, I knew there's something there, but it was really hard to find conferences where they actually had those discussions. So I've just been anti-conference for a while simply because I'm less interested in hearing about the same story over and over. I want to hear something that will wake me up to something that I never heard before.
Yeah, we had a guest on a few episodes back, Natalie Nixon. Well, Dr. Natalie Nixon. She's in Philadelphia. And one of the things that she mentioned in that episode that I thought really kind of stuck with me was saying that we need diversity in design. And I guess, you know, ostensibly that could also extend to tech and other fields as well. But particularly, she said that we need diversity in design because the more diverse the inputs, the more innovative the outputs. So it kind of, you know, falls in line with what you're saying. You want to hear from people and hear things that will kind of make you think and make you walk away with something that maybe you didn't have before.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. I mean, it's definitely something that I could take with me. There's conferences that are a little bit more technical. There's the social conferences where it's more about culture. The technical conferences I see can be very useful to people, so I do encourage them to go to those. But I just always throw out a flag when I see just pure culture conferences where they don't talk about culture from different perspectives. And it's so important, not only for people like me to hear culture and perspective talks from people that look like them, but also for our other white friends to hear perspectives from these other people that are now brave enough to get on the stage and now talk about it. And that's so important because this is a chance for you to hear and also to take back that knowledge and see how you can solve potential problems at your own place. Yes, I think it's incredibly important to have a diverse lineup, especially the topic is about creating a culture amongst your team, and that gets into inclusion.
So when do we get to hear you speak about this? I mean, it's one thing, you know, to kind of be anti-conference from the attendance level, which I totally get.
Yeah.
But what about you being that person on the stage that is that? I mean, not, you know, when I say diversity, I don't necessarily mean that just from a demographic standpoint, but, you know, the experience that you've had, not just with the work that you've done at Google, but prior to that as well, which we'll get into. People wouldn't want to hear that. People wouldn't want to hear that story, you think?
Right. Yeah. I think I'd hope to think that people would find use in the things that I experienced. You know, I did not come through the traditional design path. You know, I didn't go to design school. I was in school for computer science, and then I quit early because I wasn't interested anymore. And I was living in Iowa City at the time, and I was scared. I was scared at the time. I had no idea what I would end up doing, and one job led to another, and I ended up being at Google. I would have never imagined that. And I would hope that, you know, in a conference, I could have that opportunity to tell that story. And, you know, there's actually one that might be coming up. Can't really talk about it yet, but that might be an opportunity to take the things that I've learned and package it up in a way that could be didactic for people.
Okay. Let's go back to the University of Iowa. You said you studied computer science.
Yeah.
And, you know, looking through I looked at your LinkedIn profile, I looked at your website, and you speak about your time there very fondly, but yet you said you dropped out because you got, I guess, just tired of the education. Like, what happened there?
Yeah, I actually went to school and I enrolled in computer science because I thought I was going to get into game design. I wanted to get into game design. That was my passion back in 2000. I graduated high school in 2000. And when I was going to school, I was taking these classes. I was just turned off by the just programming in general. You know, I enjoyed programming in certain languages. I had fun in ActionScript, but at the time they were teaching COBOL and, you know, writing assembly and like writing like C, C++. And I was just like, this is not what I imagined what I'd be doing. I honestly, at the time, there was no plan to become a designer. That wasn't even on my mindset, but I was definitely focused on making a game. And on the side, I was making my own story. I was trying to write my own RPG, and it was it was a really fun kind of personal project. I made the characters. I drew the characters. I made them. I made the world. A friend of mine at the job that I worked at in college let me use his computer to design the characters using Photoshop and Illustrator. So that was my first introduction to Photoshop and Illustrator. And it was interesting where I was like, oh, I have this little world. What if I made a little website for them? So I made a website, and I don't remember the name. Maybe it was. I don't think it was Nine Line, but it was definitely a website. And that's when another person noticed, and they asked me if I could make one for them. So I was doing all this like side passion projects on the side while I was going to school. And that's when I got an internship locally in Iowa City. And then another job opportunity popped up in Des Moines to design websites at what was called Iowa Network Services. And that's when I was like, okay, I'm no longer interested in computer science. So I left. It was definitely kind of like a design was revealed to me through non-traditional means. And I realized I was pretty good at it because this side project. So definitely the moral of the story is not to drop out. But it was one of those things where I saw an alternative passion and I just doubled down on it.
Well, college is the time you're supposed to find yourself. So it sounds like that at least that much happened.
Right? Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, it was definitely scary at the time. I wish there was a playbook. You know, that's somebody told me that, you know, that you could end up leaving college and not knowing what you're really doing. Because it was scary. You know, I told my brother at the time I was considering leaving school. And, you know, I was scared to tell him because it's like that's not something that anyone is particularly proud of doing. At least me personally. So it was really hard. But thankfully, I had the right things popped up at the right times and people took chances on me. And I'm grateful for that.
When I graduated high school, I had no idea what I was going to be doing. Mm-hmm. I didn't know really what I was going to major in. I had a bunch of schools I was interested in. And I really just went to the one that gave me the most money.
Yeah.
Morehouse here in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And when I got to Morehouse, I was like, yeah, I'm going to do computer science, computer engineering. One, because I wanted to be like Dwayne Wayne from a different world. And two, because I had been working with computers in terms of like, you know, learning HTML and all this sort of stuff. And I was like, yeah, I could, you know, be someone that makes websites. Mm-hmm. And I started out that first semester and it was similar to what you're saying. We're learning like C++ and this stuff is just not like I'm sort of getting it, but it's like, this is what I have to do for a living?
Yeah.
Like, this is terrible. And I remember going to my advisor and telling him that I wanted to design websites, you know. And he was like, oh, you know, the web, that's just a fad. Like that's going to just die out. Like, nobody's designing websites. If that's what you want to do, then you probably need to change your major. And so I changed my major.
Nice.
I switched over to math and, you know, the rest was history after that. But great. I know what you mean about kind of having that non-traditional path because mm-hmm. I was always doing design stuff on the side.
Right.
And eventually, it you know, once I got my first design job in 2005, it became the crux where my hobby then became my profession, which mm-hmm. then ended up becoming my career.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. It's interesting because it's when people ask the question of, you know, how did you get into design? I'm sometimes apprehensive because I don't want to always leave that behind. It's like the way to get in. There are some really solid ways to get into design, you know, going to a design school, even though they're really expensive, or going to, you know, a traditional liberal arts school and just enrolling in the design program there. But it really is something that I think there's a lot of research to be done to figure out how design programs can be improved at some of these schools that don't really put a lot of effort into them to encourage people that are kind of on the down and out in college to really seek an alternative path. Because design is, I see it as an evolving industry that's more than just mobile and app design. I see it as something that needs to evolve to solve real problems or to evolve to solve social problems. You know, when I think about design, I don't think about politics. When I think about design, I don't think about food shortage or water shortage or climate. You know, so can that change? So I think right now when I think about design, I think about mobile apps and games and cars and houses. So I hope that there's a lot of really good perspectives on this topic where you know, designers are starting to find their footing and align themselves with the business to find more business-oriented roles where you're bringing the design discipline to those roles without having to actually design. So that's something that's starting to happen.
Yeah, a lot of that is happening. Mm. I mean, some of that is through the efforts of AIGA, right. Some of that is through, you know, a lot of individual efforts. Mm-hmm. Partly what you said about how design is not necessarily seen as part of other mm-hmm. like other, I don't know, other parts of the mm-hmm. world or other things that we experience. Mm-hmm. You know, I tell people that everything that we use passes through some level of design. Mm-hmm. And it's been that way kind of since birth. We know the clothes we wear, mm-hmm. the cars we drive, mm-hmm. you know, everything has some sort of designed experience mm-hmm. in some way. Right. And so because we have that much interaction with it, we know kind of innately when something is poorly designed. Mm-hmm. We know when something could be better designed. Right. We don't necessarily, I mean, it's almost an innate sense in a way because of our exposure to it over time. Mm-hmm. There was a conference in 2015 mm-hmm. called the Black Design Conference. Mm-hmm. This took place in Harvard, the Harvard Graduate School of Design. And it was an interesting conference because all of the speakers were designers, but they were designers, I want to say, in different ways. Like there would be a designer who put together programs to teach their local neighborhood about better eating habits, or a designer that talks about the work that he does restoring old African American historic landmarks, right. or a designer that talks about how she used history and geometry to redesign like a public square in Brazil or something like that. And it was such an interesting application of seeing how people took their creativity and just applied it in ways that weren't on a computer screen.
Right, right.
They're going to have the conference, I think, again this year.
I'll have to look into that.
I'm like, I am on them. Like, let me know how I can help. Because I went to it in 2015. Yeah. And it was, you know, I tell people it's the first event that I've been to that I feel like affirmed me as both a designer and a black person.
Right. Interesting.
Like there was, you know, they did have, you know, these cultural elements, specific cultural elements. They had like a soul yoga in the morning. Mm-hmm. They had a soul food chef, mm-hmm. Bryant Terry, that did like catered meals and stuff there. And they had these little kind of interstitials between some of the panels that would be maybe a choir singing or a dance mm-hmm. performance. And it was a little odd. Well, I mean, odd because when you go to a design conference, you don't really expect to see it. But it still was something where it kind of encouraged people in the audience to talk among themselves. And I mean, it was packed. Mm. It was standing room only.
Interesting.
So they're going to have it again this year. I am staying on them to get information because I'm like, as soon as there's something, let me know how Revision Path can help out. I will be there again. It was cheap. I hate to kind of put that part out there, but we know that sometimes these events can be pretty cost prohibitive. But it was the most expensive ticket was
$50. Oh, that's good.
And I was like, shit, let me just. Yeah. I just took a plate up from Atlanta. I was like, $50. I got that. I got that in my wallet. Let's do it. Let's make it happen. Yeah. So, but I know what you mean. It's that exposure to kind of, you know, how design can be used in these different spaces. And it really kind of had, it was the kind of event that I walked away from feeling like I could take what I know and put it towards so many other sorts of things. And even now, I mean, you know, I think even just what's happened recently in terms of, you know, the outcome of the presidential election last year has galvanized a lot of designers into seeing how they can use their skills towards civic engagement, mm-hmm. which is great. Mm-hmm. I mean, I kind of hate that it took something like that, mm-hmm. but it's working. Yeah. So people are seeing ways that they can, you know, kind of transform their communities and their neighborhoods mm-hmm. by, you know, even if it is building tools, or maybe it's getting active, or maybe it's designing flyers, but it's something.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. Yeah, I'm also starting to see that happen as well. And I think that is the only silver lining that I'm starting to see is I've never seen this many people talk about race. Even the conversation that we've always had about, you know, we need to have a real conversation about race in this country. It's like, well, this is it. This is as good as it gets. this is it. It's not gonna get any more peaceful. It's not gonna get any more darker. This is it. And I think once we start seeing people transition or make that that pivot on the things that they work on, you know, I personally I joined Daydream in early November, or at least I made the decision in late October to say, okay, I want to join this team. And then November 8th happened. And, you know, there is a part of me that is, okay, what am I doing to really improve things? There's also a part of me that says, you know, black people have been through a lot, you know, find the things that you're passionate in and like really go after those things. Learn the skills that you need to and the things that you're passionate about. But remember that you have a unique perspective on things. You're going to go through things unconsciously, even that not many people will. And I think it's valuable to share those stories. And I hope that the platforms that we continue working on in the industry, from social platforms and civil engagement platforms, the more voices are coming out. I've personally started shifting the voices that I've started listening to. I've changed most of my following on Twitter to be more trans voices from the transgender community, to hear what they're saying, to what they're going through. And that's just Twitter. And it's changed everything. I'm also pivoting a lot of the voices that I'm listening to Black women, because I haven't worked with a lot of Black women in my time. I want to make sure that when I talk about diversity, I'm not just talking about diversity for Black men. Mm-hmm. And even if I'm talking about product design, that I'm not just creating user profiles and user scenarios for upper middle class men. It completely changes the product that you work on when you change the parameters of who you're designing for.
Are you finding that, I guess, Google as a company, do you think they're sort of moving towards that? I know, and the reason I'm bringing that up is there's always, you know, talk about diversity in Silicon Valley with different companies, and Google, along with other, you know, large companies of its size, kind of tends to be in the spotlight when it relates to not just, well, this is what the diversity of our workforce is, but also the initiatives and the programs and things that they support or that they put out.
Right. Yeah, I think I've always felt appreciative of what they do internally. You know, there's kind of like an official thread that Google has in terms of how they like to talk about diversity and whatnot. But I think personally, though, I've been grateful of the not only the public announcements that they make, but also the internal ones. You know, to be able to come to work every day and see a collection of people from different cultures is one, a reward in itself. And then two, when something does happen in the world, there's usually a collection of video calls where people get to share their stories internally. And you know, you can hop in on those calls and listen to them. And it's just nice to see that everybody at this company has access to those kinds of things should they want to pursue them.
As you go through your work, what is it that keeps you motivated and inspired to continue?
My kids, I have twin boys. They definitely influenced me to get into VR simply because of the gaming aspect. But yeah, to keep me going, there's kind of a spite in me where I was like, you know what? A Black man can't succeed in this industry. So it's like there's a little bit of that, but the
really?
Yeah, it's like I haven't seen that until recently. I haven't seen a lot of Black men in design, but there's kind of like a small part of me that's like, you know what? Like, it feels pretty good to be considered a successful designer.
I was gonna say, like, even at their level, you feel.
Yeah, I feel it's. But the most important thing, though, is like my family, being able to go home and see their faces and be able to take care of them is the most important thing. And just be proud of what I work on. I like being able to tell people that I work on this stuff. It's a personal pride for me. But there is like lately, though, because of seeing like more data come out about how few voices there are in the industry, it is kind of nice to know that I'm part of a growing number of people in this industry. Yeah.
Are you familiar with the group Bay Area Black Designers?
Bay Area Black Designers? No. Sounds familiar, but...
Okay, so you should check it out. The woman that runs it, her name is Kat Veos. She's been on the show before, I think episode like 133 or something like that. She puts on a monthly meetup. I think if you just go to meetup, search for Bay Area Black Designers, it's I think about 100 plus strong.
That's awesome. In terms of membership. That's awesome.
Check it out. Tell her you're.
This makes me.
Definitely check it out.
Yeah.
Because there's people from, you know, all throughout the Bay that are a part of that group. And eventually, if I make it out there, I want to be able to try to go to a meeting just so I can say that I've been. But she's doing some phenomenal work. So if you're looking for more, I think that's a good place
to start. Yeah, definitely down to check this out. Yeah, I'm going to look that up. Thank you. Yeah, definitely. I've been going to some meetups where it's like maybe a handful of individuals, but definitely looking for something with a lot more volume.
Yeah, definitely check that out. And, I mean, you're in the Bay. I don't know if AIGA San Francisco is doing some stuff around diversity, but I do know the diversity chair, his name is Julio Martinez. He's doing some great stuff. And actually, I don't know what his actual title is on AIG. I think it's something with education. But his name is Steve Jones, and he teaches at San Francisco State University, who has also been on the show. I want to say like episode 11 or 12 or something like that. Seek them out, okay, too. I mean, I don't know what other stuff AIG San Francisco does locally, but I do know the diversity chair there. Nice. So he would be probably a good resource.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's definitely, last year was kind of a massive uptick in meeting other Black designers, particularly, you know, Dan Lee Davis from Facebook and Steve Johnson from Netflix. And, you know, it's really nice to start to hear about these organizations that are popping up. So I can feel it. It's growing exponentially. It makes me good. It makes me feel good. Yeah, I'm definitely going to look at the Bay Area Black designers because I definitely want to meet up with more folk.
Yeah.
Check it out.
Did you always kind of want to move out west? I know you said you grew up in Iowa. Well, you went to University of Iowa, but you grew up there as well.
Yeah, I grew up in Iowa, in Iowa City, Cedar Rapids. No, there wasn't an ultimate goal to move out to the West Coast. I was, when I was working in Des Moines, the web director from Oakley emailed me asking if I was interested in moving to Cellar, California, and it was hard to turn that down. So it was a kind of a dream come true at that time, and I think the that's what opened up the door to the new opportunities. Yeah, but no, there wasn't a grand plan to move to California.
Was creativity like a big part of your childhood?
Yeah, definitely was. I spent a lot of time drawing, spent a lot of time just playing with my twin brother, just like, you know, drawing our own pictures. We used to draw pictures of Battletoads, which I hope people still remember.
I remember Battletoads. I'm that old. I remember. Don't kidding.
Yeah, Pimple, and I don't remember their names enough, but yeah, Pimple is the only one I remember.
Oh, it was Rash.
Yes.
Zit and something.
All these.
There were three of them, but I remember Rash and Zits or something like that.
I love that they're all named after facial punishes. That's good. So, but yeah,
there was a Pimple in there. They had a friend named Pimple.
That's right. Yeah,
but it was Rash, Zits, and was it just the two?
I feel like there was three. I thought there was three.
Yeah, I feel like. I remember Rash and Zits. Maybe Pimple was the other one. I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah.
Oh, you know what? I'm looking it up now. It is. It's Rash, Zits, and
Nice.
Pimple.
That's good. Oh, man. I love that they did that. But yeah, we used to draw pictures of them. And so, yeah, we would always draw stuff. It's actually interesting that you asked that question because that was like probably the extent of the creativity that I had growing up. And then going into college, you know, making my own story. But I do find that fascinating, though, is one thing I started to notice when I moved out to California. I was working at these, you know, very talented teams, very talented people. They were sharing a lot of the same stories about their childhoods. You know, they grew up with like a computer in the household where their mom or their dad were either engineers or they were designers or architects or something. And they would, you know, either like fiddle with a computer or they'd have their own. They would play games on it. They'd sometimes take it apart, but they would, you know, they would watch the Star Wars, Star Trek, the Jetsons, and all these very high technical things that I was definitely not doing as a kid. And it's interesting how a lot of that stuff is starting to influence a lot of the technology that's coming out today. And that's why I'm very optimistic about what's happening and where the design culture is leading, where we're focused on accessibility for a lot of people. Because it really is a 20-year plan, in my opinion, to distribute a lot of these experiences to people that wouldn't otherwise see them, so that in 20 years or so, maybe the lineup is actually more diverse because of it. I hope that the simple act of having phones that are more accessible, like our Androids and whatnot, being able to play games with them, be able to, like, you know, the little Kano computer kits, you know, stuff like that. I'm glad that those are coming out because more kids are getting access to them, especially ones in underprivileged communities. And I hope that it has the same effect that I'm seeing right now. I hope.
Yeah, like the Raspberry Pi and the little Arduino kits. I would have killed to have that kind of stuff as a kid.
Yeah.
I remember I had... What did I have? I mean, I grew up with sort of science. Well, I grew up with different sciencey stuff. My mom's a biologist. So we grew up with like hard science stuff. Like I knew how to like dissect animals. But I mean, I also had an older brother. I have an older brother. He's 4 years older, and we would sort of share toys. So he would have like this big, like 144 in one electronic kit, which was like one of these like box. It was like a shallow box with all these transistors and circuits, and you could hook different things up to it and like make a clock or make a FM radio or something like that. And he had this like technical set called Capsella. It was like the precursor to Kinect or Lego Mindstorms, but like all of the connectors were like these spheres that had these hexagonal connectors, and you could put floaties on them and make a boat with a motor and like all this different kind of stuff. And recently I have started going back, and this is so dumb. I recently have started going back and purchasing the old computers I had as a kid just to have them. Because to me, it like reminds me of what kind of made me want to get into all of this stuff in the first place. Like I had a talking WizKid thing that had these cards that you slide into it. I had a Laser 50 VTech computer. I mean, it's like trash by today's standards, but it's about the size of, I don't know, maybe like a standard keyboard, but it had a little display on it, and like that's where I learned how to program in BASIC, because you could do little like BASIC programs. And then from there I moved up to like a VTech pre-computer 1000, where I used that to learn how to type, and I learned BASIC on that, and I learned how to make music on that, because it had a sound program where you could program out the different tones and octaves, and then it was from there that I like took up music in school and stuff like that. But like I've started just recently going back and getting these little, like, because now you can get them on eBay for like $40 or something, and I just look at it, it's like, this is what made me want to do what I do now. Like at the times when I feel like, oh, I don't feel like doing it anymore, like I'll look at it, I remember when it was fun, when it was something where you learned out of, I don't want to say out of necessity, because these were very limited tools. They were toys, essentially. But when you look at what, you know, kids have now, and the plethora of apps and devices and games, I mean, technology's come a long way. Really long way.
It really is. Yeah. And I have no idea what 20 years from now looks like. You know, the kids that are experiencing those things now, are they going to be motivated enough to make the things that they experience when they're kids better? Because they're already pretty good, you know, but I wonder where the industry is going to be in 15, 20 years or so, and what the level of emulation is going to be like. Yeah. You know, it's kind of like I think our generation is fascinating because we experienced everything from analog to what we have now. You know, I think it's just, going to like the days of Atari all the way up until virtual reality. I think it's fascinating that we have insights into both of those cultures. So I think that's pretty cool.
And I mean, and, you know, like I said, for me, like when I get these computers, it's also important to realize, and I guess to still have that sense of wonder about the work that we're doing, even though the technology has gotten so big and so grand, like still having that sense of wonder and amazement and whimsy and fun, really, about the work. I mean, this is not something that everybody has the chance or the opportunity to do, to make the kind of stuff that you're making, to do the kind of things that you're doing, you know. It's a real privilege.
It really is. Yeah, it really is. Yeah, it's definitely aware of that, and look to make sure that I don't lose sight of that, because there's a lot of people that would want to be in the shoes that I'm currently in. Definitely aware of that. But yeah, I think it was, you know, it's something as simple as, you know, representation. Like when I saw the trailer for Star Wars and John Boyega, you know, was there. And I was tearing up in the trailer, because, you know, I did grow up watching Star Wars, but to see, you know, in a modern trailer and a very classic film showing a John Boyega and Daisy, her name's Daisy, right? Daisy. Yeah. Showing them starring together in that film. I was just like, man, this is awesome. So yeah, I just got like really emotional, because I just think about like the kids that are going to see that now, you know, like, the same people that I talk to now. It's like, oh yeah, Troy, this when Star Wars came out, it was so awesome. It's like, but like, you know, 15 years, what's going to be that awesome thing to talk about? You know, so yeah, I wish I had the computer growing up. I wonder how different my path would have been if I had more devices growing up.
Well, I mean, even when I think about it, like for myself, because, you know, for a while I did want to do programming. Like, I guess if you could call it design, I mean, we created USA rocket ships in BASIC. So, like, we had, like, this really super, I mean, it was BASIC, the programming language, but you could make little graphics and stuff. And, I mean, I kind of taught myself HTML. And so that's why by the time I got to college, I was really interested in it. And the school I was at, they were just like, we don't have that. And I switched to math, and I was still kind of, you know, doing stuff on the side, taught myself Photoshop and a bunch of other, you know, kind of apps. And, you know, it's to the point now where, again, took that hobby, turned it into a career. But even now, if somebody wants to come up, like, people will ask me, you know, what should I learn? And you know, what school should I go to? I was like, I don't know. I reverse engineered stuff. Yeah. Because I was from a small town, and the nearest bookstore was 50 miles away.
Yeah.
So there was no just going to pick up a book on computer programming, because one, it was the 80s, so it didn't really exist. And two, by the time we did get there, it's like, is this something that people are still using? Because, like, I could get the book, but that doesn't necessarily mean I've got access to the device to learn how to really kind of use this thing. Library had one book on BASIC. It was this green book. And I mean, I checked that thing out every 2 weeks for about 5 years. Just like, as soon as I was checking it, I would check it right back out so I could keep learning. But that's all I had. That's all I had. Now, I mean, you've got Treehouse and all number of, you know, General Assembly and all this kind of stuff. So people ask me that, and I'm like, I have no idea. I was self-taught. I mean, there's so much out there. I could understand people having that paralysis of not knowing where to begin. But there was something that you mentioned before that I think is really important. For you, you really got into learning, you know, design and learning how to code from a passion project. You were interested in your RPG that you wanted to create. And from there, that's when you started learning these tools and learning these these different things. And so that is what I tell people, like, find a project or something that you want to build. And that's how you learn, because it's something that you've got the drive to do. And you're not just copying stuff out of the
book. Exactly. I think you're totally right. I think that's and that actually is what happened recently. I sometimes forget about this, is the reason I know how to use Unity was because I wanted to create, you know, like those topography maps that show terrain layers, right? Yeah. So I wanted to make one of those for the map that I made 10 years ago. And I was going to make it on paper, where I created, like, I'd cut out different pieces of paper and I'll lay them on top of each other with spacers. But it was really hard to do. It's like, oh, I could just make this in, like, a 3D program. And what's the best 3D program right now? It's like, oh, it just happens to be Unity. Oh, Unity's pretty good. This is pretty fun. It's like, oh, there's actually bunch of VR designers that are using Unity right now. It's like, actually, VR would be pretty fun to do. So it's interesting how the thread happens. And yeah, I think the passion projects are the best way to find what you want to do. There's a couple friends of mine that are finding their passion in writing. And I think that's really awesome. I think there's definitely a lot. You can jump more hoops, I think, when you are definitely more passionate about the space that you're in. I can never be a financial analyst. It just struggles. Like, I need some sort of game mechanic here, because I just can't do this. I need something. But yeah, I think being able to tie it back to something helps me remember. Plus, you know, when I show the little experiences to my kids, I can, they love games. So I'll build something in Unity, like, real quick, and I'll just, like, let them walk around in the world. I mean, it's not even a game. It's just, like, an environment. It's like, did you make this? So that is a joy in itself.
Do you still want to make that RPG one day?
I do. I'm conflicted on whether or not I want to make it a game versus a graphic novel or something. Yeah, but I definitely appreciate the fact that I get to use Unity on a daily basis now, so I can probably accelerate its development because of that. But yeah, it's definitely something I want to do before I pass.
Well, if there's any industry that definitely needs more diversity, it's gaming. I mean, not just game design, but also the the end product. Right. I feel like last year, I think, was the first year. It may have been, it may not have been the first year, but it's the first year I can remember where there were two AAA games that came out that both had a black protagonist. Right. That being Mafia 3 and Watch Dogs 2 for people that are wondering. But I was like, I don't recall that ever happening. Like, maybe one? Maybe. Definitely not.
Like a customizable character, maybe.
maybe a customizable character. But even, like if I'm playing, Skyrim or something like that. But I mean, by design, the main character is a person of color. And you're like, that's... And when I say a person of color, not blue, not like it's a black person or a Hispanic person or an Asian person. No, I'm serious. Right. Like it's the first time that I really recalled that. It reminds me of this interview I did with Olivier Madiba, who is a game designer in Cameroon. Mm. And he had an idea. He was, when we did the interview, he had an idea for a video game that he started, I want to say back in like 2000. Mm. And like he kept building the idea and iterating on it. He eventually built the country's first gaming company called Kiro Games. And in 2014 or 15, I have to go back and look, but they finally released the game to the public. You can buy it on Steam. It's called Arion Legacy of the Cory O'Don. It's like an action RPG game. It features all these elements of, I don't want to say African elements, because Africa is a big continent with a lot of countries and a lot of cultures, but it features these cultural elements that really I think could only be pulled off if the person that's programming it is from Africa or from a country in Africa.
Interesting. I think that would be, I definitely want to look that up. That's, I would love to play more games that actually feature not only lead black characters, but also are actually about black or African culture. That would be awesome. What did you say it was called?
It's called Arion, A-U-R-I-O-N.
Interesting.
Legacy of the Cory O'Don. Oh. I'll put a link to it for people that are listening. I'll put a link to it in the show notes.
Yeah.
I think if you just look up Arion, you'll find A-R-I-O-N.
Yeah.
Or you could go to revisionpath.com and search for it. And you'll find the interview, and I think I've got a link to it here in the show notes.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. That's, because I can't think of a single, I mean, there's only maybe two games I can think of off the top of my head that are based in Africa, which is like one, that crazy Resident Evil game. Which
I was going to say, don't say Resident Evil.
I was just about to say that.
Yeah,
I was like, oh man, it's like the fact that we're thinking about the same one is not good. And then maybe the new Metal Gear, but that was like, it's bad. Yeah. It's not like this. I just looked up an image of it and that looks gorgeous. This is like my kind of game, so I'm downloading this the moment that I get home. Nice. But yeah, that looks awesome. It's just awesome to, like, whenever I'm playing like a game like The Division, I make a black character. And I will note that The Division, the character creation, one of the characters actually is uncanny to me. He looks exactly like, it's almost scary. Like, my wife was walking past the TV and she was like, what? It is not like a game full customization either. They just happens to look like. But I just think it's fascinating that, like, how much more fun it is to play when you can relate to the character in some ways. Mass Effect, I think, did a pretty good job, even though that was like custom character. I think they did a good job, though, making sure that they weren't just releasing trailers for the male character. They released trailers for the female version of Shep as well. I thought that was really cool how they did that. So I think there is a huge value in diverse cast. Fast and the Furious has seen the benefit of that. Yeah. The record number of sales every year from different cultures because they feature people from different cultures. So it's a actual financially beneficial to make your cast more diverse. You can reach it for.
No, we're definitely, even seeing that with Hidden Figures, which is, I think, the first Best Picture nominee that is like, I don't know, like super high grossing. It's like over 130 million grossed for the movie so far. That's amazing.
Exactly. And I think that's you start to reach a bigger audience and you start to motivate them to want to extend the stories. The fact that we could only think of one game that was based in Africa, other than this Arion game, is problematic. Yeah. I think there is a good thing to happen about making sure that not only are the stories about different cultures, but they're not the same representation of that culture. For example, a lot of the movies, when I think about movies about Africa, a lot of people think about war-torn Africa. And that's not good because, you know, it is not a war-conflicted continent. It is a pretty large as the land with a lot of different cultures. I mean, I think that a lot of the stories aren't being told, but the only ones that we keep seeing are the ones where, you know, there's child soldiers and exports of like drugs and stuff. So it's like the only message that's coming out about Africa, or at least in the mainstream. I think that's sad. So I'm really hopeful to see more African diaspora, or just like more African content. I mean, even Disney is doing a better job than most with I saw The Lion King in the musical, and I was blown away. I cried at the beginning because it was the most amazing display of like a colorful African culture with black men and women actors on stage performing. And I was just like, man, this is beautiful. I think it's like stuff like that. I would love to see more stuff like that. I would love to immerse myself in, even spend more time learning about African culture that I don't know about, because I'm sure there's a lot that I don't know. I know there's a lot that I don't know. Yeah.
Are you familiar with Nollywood?
Nigerian Hollywood? If you couldn't tell by my name, it's Nigerian. Yeah, my parents, they're obviously both Nigerian. They spent a lot of time watching Nigerian movies. They have a large collection, I hope. One of them that they might be seeing, $1. It is $1's name of a film. It is the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen. It was amazing. But yeah, Nollywood is awesome. It's the most, it's like one of the biggest movie industries, like other than but Bollywood and Hollywood, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's funny. I saw that on a Vice trailer, like Hollywood is third.
Yeah.
I think either Nollywood or Bollywood is the top, but Hollywood is like far behind that.
That's awesome. That's awesome. That makes me happy, and I'm glad that there's like a film industry there. My parents love those. I wish there was like a Netflix just for that.
Just for Nollywood? Yeah. You know what? I feel like there probably is. There might be Nigerian movies on Netflix.
No, actually, that's a good question. There could be. That's a good question. But yeah, it's they usually just get them from like little DVDs and whatnot. But you know, there's something sweet about the production value. But I think I love explosions in movies and whatnot. But I think it's nice to see that there's an entire industry there coming out for that. So it's only going to get better, which is good.
Where do you see yourself in the next like 5 years or so? What do you think it'll be?
Oh man, you know, I would have had a different answer for you in October. I would hope that I'm working on something to improve. I guess I'll put it like a top three things that I hope I'm doing. So one, I hope I'm working in civil engagement to actually help improve the reach of technology to marginalized communities. I hope I'm working on something in that regard. I'm starting to gain a lot of respect and admiration for city planning. Even though working in government, that doesn't sound very enticing. I think it's really awesome to think about like transportation design or just general like city layouts and residential planning. I think that stuff is interesting. So not one of those non-traditional design roles. And then three, working on something in the music industry. I don't know why, but I think there's something fun about like, I don't know much about music production at all. That should be more accurate. I know zero about music production. Okay. So I think it would be kind of fascinating to like pivot to that. So those are my top three, just civics, city planning, and music. But I definitely see myself still focused on design. That's my strongest deliverable right now. I don't know if that's going to change, but I think that's where I see myself the strongest.
Well, just to wrap things up, where can our audience find out more about you and about your work online?
Right now, I mean, my portfolio, Nine Lion Design, it's just a quick snapshot of me. I've started to spend more time on Twitter. My Twitter handle is just Chick. Occasionally, I'll talk about design. I'll link to good resources for people. I am considering creating a blog. I'll keep you posted on that if I do. But right now, just follow me on social or or check out my website, connect me through there. I'm definitely interested in helping mentor people or guide people in the direction that they're hoping. So I'm always okay with one-to-one communication. So just reach out to me on social for that kind of stuff. But
sounds good. Well, Chikwesi Ejiofor, man, thank you so much for coming on the show, for sharing your story, you know, telling us about what you're doing with the work at Google and everything. Mm-hmm. You know, I still, you know, kind of keep, you know, in my mind, I'm going back to what you're saying about, you know, being anti-conference, not to bring it up in a bad way, but to kind of, you know, also just sort of put forth the impression of, you know, you can't be what you don't see, like for the generation of designers that are coming up, that, you know, the work that you're doing is important. It's work that should be seen. And I think even just you being where you are right now and the path that you've taken to get there is something that I think a lot of people could find inspiration in. They could certainly, I think, get lessons from that. So don't be shy about sharing that. I don't think you should. Not that you are shy, but I mean, I can understand how going to these kinds of events, you can start to think like, well, you know, this is just, it's a sausage. I don't see what I really contribute to any of this, but your unique path to get where you are now, the interest that you have, I think are something that a lot of people would want to hear from. So thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's been an honor. Thoughts of love are in your
mind. And that's it for this week. Big thanks to Chikwesi Ejiofor, and thanks to you for listening. You can find out more about Chikwesi and his work through the links in the show notes at provisionpath.com. Also, thanks as always to our sponsors, Facebook Design, MailChimp, Hover, and SiteGround. Facebook invests in design. They care deeply about how their design team might do their best work, and that manifests itself in a number of different ways, such as showing how internal design critiques work at Facebook, sharing resources about VR and other cutting-edge tech, and by giving away great tools and resources like Origami Studio, popular device templates for Photoshop and Sketch, and even diverse hands for mockups. Learn more about Facebook design at facebook.com/design. More than 15 million businesses around the world use MailChimp to grow their businesses and make money in their sleep. Speaking of which, I've talked before about setting up Facebook ads, you know, in MailChimp. But if you use MailChimp for e-commerce, like if you have a store or anything like that, you can now add order notifications for shipping, for refunds, orders, and cancellations. So all of that ties right into your MailChimp account. It's really cool. Sign up for a free account today. MailChimp. Send better email. Hover takes all the hassle and confusion out of buying and managing your domain. With free private domain registration, like I mentioned earlier, and your choice of domains across all the 400-plus domain extensions out there, how can you turn that down? Go to hover.com/revisionpath and get 10% off your first purchase. Since 2004, SiteGround has been empowering web professionals and beginners alike to build better, faster, safer websites easily without having to worry about web hosting. Visit siteground.com/revisionpath and get 60% off on all hosting plans. SiteGround, web hosting crafted with care. This episode was edited by RJ Basilio and produced by me, Maurice Cherry. Our intro voiceover is by Music Man Dre, with intro and outro music by Yellow Speaker. If you liked this episode, please do me a huge favor. Subscribe to us on iTunes and leave us a rating and a review. It only takes a minute or two. It really helps the show by bumping us up in the iTunes rankings for design podcasts. And I'll read your review right here on the show, just like I did with JAA0829. Revision Path is brought to you by Lunch, a multidisciplinary creative studio in Atlanta, Georgia. Visit us at yepitslunch.com for all your design, strategy, and creative consulting needs. And if you like the work we're doing here with Revision Path, then please consider becoming a patron. Now more than ever, Revision Path needs your support to make sure that stories about Black designers and creatives in our field are being told in their own words. So if you support us, if you support our mission, just go to patreon.com/revisionpath and pledge today. Pledge levels start at just $1 per month, and you'll get access to behind-the-scenes information about the show, upcoming interviews, and so much more. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.